and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to The Future is Female. This is the show where we find the extraordinary in every woman. Now, today we have the privilege of diving into the fascinating world of language and literature and the arts. My guest today is Adriana Nordin-Manan, who is a playwright, writer, and translator. Her work spans languages and cultures and connects common human experiences through storytelling. I'm delighted to have her here. Hello, Adriana. How are you?
Hi, Mel. I'm very good. Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. And I wanted to, before delving into some of your work and the many hats that you wear, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your journey. And so tell us how you got interested, or what sparked your passion for language and literature and storytelling.
Wow, let's see. I think the best way I can do it succinctly is really exposure from young. I grew up in KL, and this is something that I didn't know at the time, of course. Obviously, I was too young. But I actually, my upbringing and my childhood existed in different cultural worlds, really.
Okay.
By the simple virtue of my grandparents. I had my late toh on my maternal side was Malay. She had a nice little kampung house in with the stilts and everything in Gombak. And she understood English, but she wouldn't speak a word of it. So there was that. And then I had my paternal grandmother, who's originally from Ireland. And she was trained in early childhood education, so I would also spend a lot of time with her at their house. And so it seems like even within the same day, I would actually be exposed to different cultural worlds, really, just in sense of even the food, the type of, like, the approach towards how they spent their time with me. Like, with my toh, I'd be, like, hanging around her by the kitchen. And with my nene, so my paternal grandma, she would actually have structured, like, storytelling time with us, story writing time with us. Let's go swimming, let's go for walks, let's go to the bicycling. So it seemed like it was a very, in hindsight, I think that's where it was, because when you're young, you know, you're not very verbal, you're less verbal, but things are more visceral.
Mm.
So images and just like my surroundings really like intrigued and captivated me from
was
young.
Was that enriching or was that confusing?
It was very enriching.
I
didn't think twice about it because, yeah, you're so young and like you don't know any better, right? But now in hindsight,
you think everyone lives like this, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I would be like, yay, okay, in Nenet's house, let's eat roast chicken and, you know, roast pumpkin. And then we'll like sing like nursery rhymes and then, you know, afternoon nap. But then I'd go to my toh's house and I'd like, yay, let's chase the chickens underneath the house. And, you know, the house with the stilts and traditional Malay house. And I really think that was it. And also a very encouraging family.
Okay.
They were like,
right.
Yeah. So I think they always knew I was like a bit of the storyteller, daydreamer.
Express yourself.
Yeah.
Okay. So they encouraged you. So you had this kind of multilingual journey growing up. So and maybe, you know, grew up kind of code switching from different households and different households. Talk to me a little bit about how that influenced your work as a translator. Because when you wear your translator hat, you have to be able to code switch, but also keep the essence of what it is you're translating true.
Yeah.
So what's your personal philosophy when you approach your translating work?
My personal philosophy is the gentler a read my translation is to the target audience, the happier I am and the more satisfied I am.
What does that mean, the gentler the read?
The gentler a read. So, for example, let's say it's a poem let's say, take a real life example, a report, like a policy brief, for example.
Oh, okay, so you're going to the...
Oh, that one. Oh, do you want the literary one?
Many different types of translation work.
Yeah, so let's say the general translation, let's say business policy kind of stuff. Just the simple things, for example, in English, let's say I'm translating something from English into Malay, English seems to use a lot of just certain structures, and Malay, I feel like, uses more verbs. So if you say like, it's just like just, and then what I do is that I will translate directly, like literally without thinking much, and then I will put on my Malay hat, my Malay reader hat, and being like, this comes across as a little bit convoluted, and you know, it's nobody's fault, it's just what you do, languages, and that's where I think as translators, we're almost like unpicking a little bit, reducing the tension, reducing the like, yeah, so a gentler read,
that's
meaning
what you
like,
mean by
gentler. Yeah, if it's not something, why is it so difficult for me to understand?
Right, yes.
Yeah, so I call it like a gentler read.
I love that there are such differences with different languages. So when we speak in English, sometimes it can be a little bit more succinct.
Yes.
In BM, it's very floral, very flowery, yeah. and expansive.
Yeah.
Are there words that just cannot make that transition, that translation, that it loses something in the translation?
Oh, that's a very good question. I've been asked this before. So I know an English word, for example, which I think is difficult to really to say in one word is, I mean, home in the context of like a house isn't a home. Mm. Like, how would you say that in Malay? Because like the idea of a home, right? Like, which is more than just a physical structure. And then another word that I know in English is hard to, it's quite hard to translate in Malay is vulnerability. Yeah, like
emotional vulnerability.
You know, like because vulnerability has that idea of, I think, strength, but also like softness, you know?
Yes.
And in Malay, let's say we do kelemahan, I don't think it does justice. Yeah.
Yeah, it's missing the strength element. I have to be honest with you, I struggle with translating the word manja.
Very true.
There's so many nuances to the word manja in Malay, which I struggle trying to find the English equivalent in a singular word.
Yeah.
Okay, but let's talk a little bit about the other types of translation, particularly literary works.
Yeah.
And I find that it's an art and a science, a real delicate dance and balance. Mm. How do you do that to make sure that the voice of the author remains true, but also your work as the translator shines? And I want to point to your translation of Pengap by Luqman Hakim. Congratulations, it was shortlisted for the Commonwealth Short Story Prize in 2019. Mm-hmm. That was a big deal.
That was a big deal, Adriana.
Talk to me about why that was such a big deal and how you felt you made a mark through your translation.
Oh, that was, 2019, it was the first ever Malay language submission to the CSSP, Commonwealth Short Story Prize, that was shortlisted. 20 out of 5,000 plus submissions.
Amazing.
The top 20. And till today, we haven't been able just yet to repeat that feat, but hopefully, who knows, soon. I was a lot less experienced then.
Oh,
yeah, I just gave it a try. I was just as humbled as everybody else, I think, at the news. It's a fascinating story. I remember getting a little bit stumped in that story. The translation of pa, the term of endearment, the term of respect, pa, right? And also food, I remember. And my philosophy maybe has changed since then a little bit. I translate, I forgot what his name, let's say his name was Abu. There was a character in there, and like Pa Abu. Then in my translation, you will see I translated it as Old Man Abu. Old Man Abu, you know? It was okay. But then now, Adriana, in 2023, I would maintain the Pa. I would say, nope, this is a cultural element of Malay lingo and speech, which I insist should be able to cross over into English, just as how Frau or Herr or in German or Senora, Senorita, you hear it, like people, when people translate, they take it into English even. So I was like, yes, there are certain things in Malay that I want to like cross over. And food, roti jala, I'm pretty sure, again, I translated it as net crepes. In that one. So I don't know, I might maintain roti jala or something else altogether.
But that's actually quite charming if someone is able to do that cultural bridge, who understands the Malay culture and the Malay language, and then can find the charm and the humor in net crepes.
Yes, net crepes, right?
Okay,
yeah.
So is the creative process the same when you wear your translator hat and when you wear your playwright hat? Is the creative process the same?
You know, that's very interesting, because I would say my translator hat is more adjacent to a theatre director's hat than a playwright.
Oh.
And this is something I learned while we workshopped my play, because a translator has to be so close to a piece. Like, you have to really feel it. You're like the first reader, almost like the most intimate reader. You're like, oh wow, okay, what was the imagery? Like, you really need to get to know it. Like, I have certain pieces that I can still remember vividly, the scenery, even though it's been years since I translated them. And to me, working with, workshopping my play and all, working with a director, when I observe my director in action, like looking through, like going over the text, I was like, you're doing like what I do when I'm in my translating mode.
Why is that?
Such a, it's like you're really observing and analyzing and listening and just trying to really get into a piece.
Okay.
Like I remember, for example, over Zoom, and then when I'm the playwright, like in my mind, of course, everything makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. But I remember my director asked me, Adriana, why did you choose this? Like, isn't it obvious? I wanted to say deep down in my heart. But those are questions that a translator asks on the text.
Maybe because the director is also translating your work.
Precisely.
Words into Precisely. Movement and performance on stage. So let's start with the creative process. How do you choose what stories you want to tell? Because I know you've got a lot of stories you want to tell. But how do you even begin crafting a new play and deciding, I think this story has legs and I want to tell it?
That's such a great question. The story must reach me, arrive to me, and not want to leave me. And I know you might be like, Adriana, this sounds really hokey. But
no,
it's very true.
No, I
it's
I
very
hear you.
True. Yeah. I mean,
it's first, burning yes. a hole inside you to be told.
Yeah, first there's like little flutters, like maybe in the belly a bit, and then I'll be like, eh, what is this? Like, why is it when I'm walking around or like looking at certain things, I'm like, I keep thinking about this theme, for example. And then it will enter the brain. And when it enters the brain is when I'm trying to plot generally. But that's not the strongest point. I feel like the strongest point for me in playwriting that I've learned is when it really goes down to the heart, when I open myself to be vulnerable as well. And this is specifically with playwriting, because playwriting is... I described this to a friend once. It really feels like I'm also a sculptor and a weaver. You know, the words don't just stay on like the plane of a paper, for example, but they have to envelop you, because playwriting in theatre is an interaction between text and space. Theatre makers have said. So it's. I mean, I know you didn't ask this necessarily, but. It's been one of the most challenging, if not the hardest, like most challenging thing I've done really in my life.
Okay. So you have this, your first full-length play that you've completed. Congratulations on that. It's called Fault Lines.
Fault Lines.
And it's going to debut, it's going to premiere on stage at the PJA Performing Arts Centre on the 16th of November. And I want to talk to you about the themes in it first. So. It explores themes of family, of the diaspora. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about what you wanted to convey through those themes, through Fault Lines.
Fault Lines, it was almost, at its most basic level, could I say that it was like a love letter to myself, actually. Love letter to myself in terms of Adriana, the teenager, the teenager who at that time had certain ideas based on her upbringing and, you know, her perspective of the world. And then she left for the US. It was actually because the play takes place in New York City.
It's set in New York?
Yeah, okay. But it's a Malaysian family, a Malay family from the KL area, where a few of them who have settled down in New York host a few who travel from KL. So I think I said it in a family for particular reasons, but it really was... at the heart of it, in terms of the creative process, it was really me grappling and navigating really deep, profound meta questions, I like to say, about identity while I was being Malaysian, being overseas, coming back to Malaysia and going back again for my master's. It was that period, actually. And I didn't set out to do that, actually. I was, because again, like when it's at the brain phase, right, you're like, oh, it's going to be about this topic. But that's the thing about playwriting, that when I said that it's like, it's almost like you're a sculptor and a weaver. The words need to come to life, you know, and you can, and so the own, and you cannot bore your audience, you know. So
I'm curious to know about that process of the lump of clay that it started out, and then the sculpting and the weaving, and part of that is also workshopping the idea.
Yeah.
And you've had some experience. Yes. you went through the experience of workshopping this play, and it's left its mark on you. So walk me through what that was, so that maybe other aspiring playwrights could also benefit from your experience.
Definitely. So I walk away from Fault Lines, like when we end our run, as an avowed believer in workshopping. And for me, Because I'm, you know, like self-taught, I never really, and I was just, I wanted to like get my feet wet, right, in playwriting. So I wrote a first draft by the end of 2018. And then workshopping is when you get actors to actually read out the script, you know.
Is it common practice among writers?
In the industry, but in Malaysia, maybe we can speak about that later. You don't see it very often for particular reasons, yeah. So I wrote it, and then I wasn't sure, and I was like, maybe, yeah. So I just called in, and people are so supportive, and I just called in my actor friends. Then they came, and then a few were like observers, or like dramaturgs, as we call them, where they were like just more listening and then giving feedback later. And Melissa, it was like a, gosh, like almost like transcendental experience, wow. You know, to have my words be said by people. It really felt that just from like words on a page, there was more like silhouettes of like actors, of actual people, characters. And then, I mean, it became very clear to me where the weak points in my script, the places where maybe I could tighten the conversation or maybe get to a point quicker. In playwriting, the words aren't just words to be read, they're to be felt. And like, yeah, hence the sculpting and weaving analogies. Yeah.
Is that the most rewarding part of being a playwright?
For me, yes. It was the most rewarding because it's the part that you can't explain. No?
What about the challenges? Because you said this is a deeply personal piece of work, right? It comes from within. And you're putting it out there to the world through the hands of a director and actors. It's giving up your baby.
Yes. So
how do you disentangle what is inside with what is explicit?
Yeah. No. I tell my director like, hey, it's like I'm the parent and you're the kindergarten teacher. So I'm like giving you to act. You can act in loco parentis. I'm going to be quite blunt here, but I'm over that phase, Melissa.
Oh, okay. It was a phase.
Yeah, it was definitely a phase. It was a phase.
Of couldn't let go?
Of being protective about, especially when working with a director. Mm. I was like, no, you cannot take away this word. But now, and I mean, we've been a few nights in rehearsals with table readings. I'm the one who initiates stuff because I'm like, hey, actually, Ian, we can throw away this line. Like this, I even have this new lingo vocabulary where this is prose writing. No, we must change it to theatre writing. Right. So let's cut this.
What triggered that change in you? What did you go through that allowed you to let go?
I think I look back on the journey of how far we've come, and I have a team, right? I have collaborators.
So you have trust
now.
I have trust that they will do the best to reflect your work.
We're on a shared destination. Yeah.
You've trust in the translator.
Yes, in all the translators, meaning the actors and the director, everyone, like from the lighting designer, set designer. Yeah.
Would you trust them enough to allow ad-libbing? Or, you know, how does that work in theatre? Do you stay true to the words?
Yeah.
Or are actors free to imbue what they want?
My understanding is that a playwright, I mean, let's say writing for a play and let's say writing for a TV show, let's say, people, what I've been told and I'm discovering is that the playwright has a lot more authority and power in that compared to like TV
words
writer.
Words are everything in theatre.
So the playwright, I mean, my director, the director says like, it's a privilege to have the playwright in the room. And I was like, yes, it's a privilege to have me, but in a jokey way. I just realized that maybe ad-libbing? No, I don't think so. Mm. Because I think, I mean, I would imagine that they also want to stay true to their work and their craft, right?
But also it's respect for the script, for the words. What made you choose, what drew you to theatre as, you know, you're writing for theatre? Why do you think theatre was that medium of storytelling that you chose and not something else? What does theatre bring that maybe other art forms might not be able to fully convey?
I think it's the, just in terms of my personal journey, I was exposed quite a lot to theatre and I always had an attachment to it. In school, I was in, you know, Lidra Club and the Club Theatre and all. But throughout that, I knew that I'm not an actor. I was frightfully, I still, I mean, maybe now I'm less scared, but I was frightfully, like, frightened of acting. Mm-hmm. I was like, no, I cannot. Like, I didn't understand it, and I didn't gravitate towards it. Directing, even less so. But writing, always knew was my thing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So would this make, would Fault Lines make a good Netflix film or maybe short series, you know, limited series?
Honestly, I think it could.
It could.
I'm biased, but knowing the story and the layers and the different characters, it could definitely be extended.
Well, someone from Netflix might be listening and looking to option. Who knows?
There you go.
I wanted to talk about Malaysian theatre next, mm-hmm. if I may, with you. Since you said that this is really, you gravitate towards theatre. Yeah. Your observations about mm-hmm. how the industry has evolved mm-hmm. over the years. I mean, where are we now? Where do you see the challenges, mm-hmm. the opportunities for growth? Where do you see us moving towards the future?
If describing the industry, I think the first thing people would say is that you can't really call it an industry because it just hasn't been able to grow.
Okay.
But having said that, I also want to acknowledge that theatre, now that we have, I mean, very generally speaking, there's theatre like my play, for example, where you have a script, right? You start with a script. And there's another type of theatre where you call it devised work. Mm. So that's where you come together and then you come up with a script or the pieces together as a cast, as a director. Then you come together. And there's a lot of devised work you'll see in Malaysia. And for the simple reason that writing scripts, like full scripts, takes a lot of effort and resources. And because there's maybe not as much support in new play development, for example, new works development, in terms of, I mean, sure, finances, but also like mentorship, time, feedback mechanisms, we don't have that much of it, which is why it's rare to see a new play being staged in Malaysia as opposed to devised work. I think you could see my gut feel in KL, you'd see five devised works to one Malaysian, to one like written play. In that sense. So
what do we lose when we don't have that kind of, what is the opportunity cost of not having enough of these, playwrights?
You know, I would never say that, like, oh, we lose out on, like, the stories that we have, therefore, are, like, not as good as they could have been. No, I would never say that. I think we lose out in the general ecosystem because it's a skill, it's a craft to write a play. And imagine if we had more people, and imagine the stories that could come out, you know, and with respect to other mediums of transmitting stories, like, stories in theatre is different just because the live audience presence and the slowness, the space, the interaction between space, it can be very magical if done right.
Oh, and that's wonderful. Yeah. I got goosebumps when you said that. You alluded to earlier that workshopping is missing in the industry.
Yeah.
How do we fix that?
I think, to be honest, we fix that by supporting programs of new works development. I've tried in the past, and I know I can name a few other theatre makers and practitioners who've tried new works development, but I don't know, Mel, I don't know if this is helpful, but the amount of resources you need to put in, think of it as like nothing different than wanting to have an Olympic champion in sports, for example. Mm. You need to give it time, right? You need to give it resources. You need to give mentorship.
It
needs investment. That's what I've noticed. And there are many playwrights, and I know there are many people who would like to write plays, but it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot from you. Theatre is a collaborative process, so if you could have a mechanism or to allow for that collaboration to help the playwright forward, I think that would be important. The enabling environment.
So is the environment also enabling for gender diversity and centering women's voices, women-centric stories? Mm-hmm. Is it a conducive industry for that?
You have to do the hustle yourself. You'll have to have the conviction, and you need to like champion that. Mm. I would say,
All right. Yeah. Okay. So in the minute or so that we have left, tell the audience, Adriana, about Fault Lines. Mm-hmm. What they can expect, mm-hmm. where they can get tickets, where they can watch it, and why they should go watch it.
Okay. Wow. No pressure. Fault Lines is a play that grapples with migration, diaspora, homeland, family, and also wider, like, global issues, actually, but within the framework of this family in New York. It runs from 16th till 19th November at the Petaling Jaya Performing Arts Center, or PJ PAC. You can get tickets at onetix.com.my, and it has a stellar cast. I'll just name them: Putrina Rafi, Fatima Abubakar, Reza Zainal Abidin, Sabrina Hassan, Xavier Reminik, Aluing Silalahi, and Catherine Liao. It's directed by Ghafir Akbar, set designed by Raja Malik. If you're familiar at all with the English language theatre world, at least, you will know that this is a real who's who lineup. So please do join us.
Star-studded. Thank you, Adriana, for being
on
the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all we have for you on this episode of The Future is Female. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.